The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. With prom season right around the corner, the first story that I have to share with you is titled Baby Blue Prom Dress, and this is submitted by Diana Vickery. In the 1960s, in my hometown of Aurora, Illinois, it was not uncommon for high school girls to have dresses custom made for special occasions like prom and homecoming. In some cases, the cost could be less than an off-the-rack dress that needed alterations. Many extremely talented women worked at home creating and altering clothing. To call them mere seamstresses seems an underestimation of their skills. Three houses away from ours was such a woman. Her name was Emma. The first dress Emma made for me was for homecoming at Marmarion Military Academy, a local boys' school, my junior year. The dress was a periwinkle blue, lightweight wool sheath dress, fully lined and very grown up. I loved it. But when my grandfather died 2 days before homecoming, I was in no mood for dancing, and my parents deemed it inappropriate for me to go to the event. The dress always reminded me of that sad time, and I had neither the heart nor another occasion to wear it. I don't remember what happened to it. For senior prom, I asked Emma to make a formal ankle-length gown. I bought the fabric and chose the pattern. It was suitably modest, so the nuns at Madonna High School would be happy. The dress was made of silk in baby blue with a matte finish. Over the dress, I wore a second dress made of very sheer shadow lace and a matching shade of blue. After several fittings, the dress was ready, and I walked to Emma's house to pick it up and pay her. I had saved enough from my after-school waitress job at a drugstore lunch counter, 75 cents an hour, to pay for it myself. But Emma would not take a penny. "Your father did a great favor for my husband," was all she said. I was puzzled. What kind of favor could Dad have done for Oscar that would warrant Emma not taking money for all of her wonderful work? Dad was puzzled, too. After scouring his memory, Dad remembered one occasion when he was walking by their house on his way to the hardware store and saw Oscar sitting on the porch. The two got to talking, and Dad asked, "Are you waiting for someone?" Oscar answered that yes, he was waiting for a friend to take him to the lumber yard, but it looked as if he was not coming. Emma and Oscar, post-World War II immigrants to the United States, did not own a car. "When I get back from the store, if your friend hasn't arrived, I'll take you to the lumberyard," said Dad. My father always had a soft spot in his heart for immigrants like Emma and Oscar, as his own parents had been immigrants just before World War I. When Dad walked by on his return trip, Oscar was still waiting, so Dad drove him to the lumberyard. Dad didn't think a trip to the lumberyard was that big a favor, but apparently Emma did, and I benefited from it. My baby blue dress was perfect, and I felt like a princess wearing it. After prom was over, I asked Emma to alter the dress's hem to knee length so I could wear it under my graduation robe. The dress plays a prominent role in the photo album I kept and still have. Looking at those photos always makes me smile and think of our neighbor, Emma, and how even tiny favors can have oversized meaning to the recipients. Another event that happens during the spring is spring cleaning, and that's the title of an article submitted by Lynn Cassidy. Spring cleaning changed when heating houses during the winter went from wood and coal fuel to propane and gas, and later to electricity. Wood smoke and coal dust settled over everything during the winter when the house was shut up to conserve heat. Getting that residue out of the house was first on every housewife's agenda when the windows were opened in the spring. Although she later married, my great aunt Laverne Harris was a spinster school teacher in 1933 and lived with her parents on their farm near Dearborn, Missouri. Her journal for that year included many references to spring cleaning. While reminiscing with family members about spring cleaning back then, we recalled how each room was cleared and the furniture moved out. Sometimes entire rooms would be painted, or sometimes just the woodwork in the room. Windows were not just washed. The storm windows were taken down, cleaned, and put away, while screens were cleaned and took their place. Feather beds were removed to the porch. The feathers were taken from old bed ticking and new feather beds were made. This job would have been easier if the younger brothers had been kept away. One brother did a nosedive onto the new bed before it could be sewed shut. Feathers were discovered in the oddest places all that summer. Gravel road dust, coal, and wood grime all were made short work of when it was possible to open windows and let fresh air in. As a cousin remembered, there wasn't anything not touched once spring cleaning commenced. Another cousin found out just what anything was when she helped an older lady with her spring cleaning. She was handed a toothbrush and told to clean each individual spring after the mattress was removed. There were hundreds of springs. 30 years later, my mom's spring cleaning didn't include toothbrushes on the bed springs or varnishing the woodwork in every room. Heating innovations that prevented dust and grime from accumulating over the winter helped make spring cleaning a little easier. However, in 1963, Mom's spring cleaning bordered on fanatic as she prepared for her brother's wedding reception at our house in Dearborn, Missouri. Mom didn't work outside the home after I was born in 1952. Inside the home, however, there were seven of us, so she worked harder seeing to our needs than if she had been employed. This included cleaning the house every weekend for family gatherings, but the family gathering for the wedding reception included a level of cleaning I hadn't seen in my 10 years on this earth. After her usual weekend cleaning, I knew something big was happening when Mom shined the chrome on the toaster, and then she put it away in a cabinet. We never put the toaster away. Johnson paste wax was used on every floor. Dollies were starched and could have stood up by themselves, and each flat surface in the house was cleared and polished. Linen tablecloths were ironed, and silverware was polished. While the five of us girls even had our patent leather shoes buffed and our can-cans ironed. This period of extreme cleaning might have been when Mom wore out her first buffer. She semi-retired a second one after she had wall-to-wall carpeting installed over those beautiful hardwood floors in the house my parents built in 1966. 11 years after Mom's spring cleaning frenzy, it was my turn to understand the vigorous scrubbing for her brother's wedding reception. In 1974, I was hosting a wedding shower picnic supper for a college friend to reciprocate for a shower she had held for me the previous year. Our small house of two bedrooms, living room, dining room, and kitchen was clean to within an inch of its life. The morning of the party, I rolled up the room-size area rug, damp mopped the hardwood floor, put down paste wax, and buffed the paste wax before dragging out the Kirby sweeper to vacuum the area rug. Only then did it go on my newly waxed living room floor. The kitchen linoleum was scrubbed before I poured no wax liquid on it. Even before doing that, I turned the vintage chrome kitchen table upside down to scour the legs with SOS soap scouring pads. The sheer curtains took a turn in the washing machine, as did the kitchen rugs. The Kirby hose attachment scrubbed over the sofa and chairs, and the tall, wavy glass windows were polished squeaky clean. Then we cooked supper for 10 guests. I then understood why my great aunt went to bed with the chickens after spring cleaning. Next, we have a story submitted by Douglas Clark, and it's titled Life in the Mountains of East Tennessee. In the mountains of East Tennessee during the 1950s, life changed with the seasons. In late spring, winter clothes, including the dreaded long johns, were taken off and stored for the next winter. Most enjoyed was the removal of our big high-top brogans we called quad hoppers. These shoes were heavy as lead and picked up a ton of mud. As soon as possible, going barefoot was the order of the day. Over the winter, our feet had become tender. There were many ways to toughen them up, but my favorites were wading in the rocky bottom creek and climbing trees. Kids going bare hoof, as Dad called it, had to be careful and watch where they stepped. Stepping on a briar or thorn was painful, but most dreaded was a stone bruise or a stumped toe. But what I remember most about the mountains is not the stumped toes or winter clothes. It is the distinctive sounds and smells of the mountains, our home, and our farm. The morning wake-up call came from our rooster, Big Red. I sat up in bed and took a deep breath and listened. The sizzle and smell of bacon frying filled my senses, but most enticing was the aroma of Mom's fresh-baked biscuits. After breakfast, it was my lot in life to gather eggs and feed the farm animals. I paused before entering the barn and inhaled the fragrance of honeysuckle growing along the old logging road. I listened to the songbirds as they welcomed the new day. High in the sky, the wild geese were winging and honking their way back north. After bringing down hay from the barn loft, my next stop was the chicken house. When I entered, all the hens were out in the barnyard except one, Henrietta. All the others were Rhode Island Reds, but she was a Dominecker and protected her nest and eggs as if they were gold. She watched me as I gathered the eggs, and when I came near, she rose up and spread her wings. I made a detour. If anyone wanted her eggs, they could come and get them. As I stepped from the chicken house, I paused and listened. Suddenly, there sounded the long, mournful whistle of the Louisville and Nashville morning train. The shrill traveled up from the valley and echoed through the surrounding mountains. The engineer was warning anyone near Wilson's Crossing that the train was gathering speed to climb the grade at Hickory Ridge. As the blare of the train whistle faded, I felt a longing. "Someday I'm going to ride on that big train all the way to Nashville," I whispered. Once a week it was our chore to remove the weeds and rocks from the family garden. I carried my hoe and the rock bucket. Buddy Earl carried his hoe and our fruit jar of water. By early morning, the weeds were chopped down and the bucket of rocks was dumped on the rock pile. We were ready for a short rest. As we passed the barn, our older brother Harold was at the grinding wheel sharpening our three axes. He looked up and pointed toward the house. "You two better get a move on. Mama is going to send one of you to the store." Being older than Buddy Earl, I knew it was going to be me. After receiving my marching orders, I hurried out the door and read the list. Baking powder, salt, and yeast. I knew this meant Mama would be baking bread come Wednesday. Our family had a weekly schedule. Monday was wash day, Wednesday was baking day, Saturday was going to town, and Sunday was always church. Although it was only a dirt path, I decided to travel the shortcut down the mountain. As I approached the small country store, I saw a familiar sight. Two older men sitting on the bench outside were swapping stories of the mountains. I wanted to stop and listen as they told of haints that roamed the mountains and the cries of wampus cats. Most of all, I enjoyed the tale of long-abandoned log cabins and what might have happened to the folks who once lived there. Soon, I would be 13 years old and allowed to roam the mountains if I took my dog Ranger and Old Tom with me. Old Tom was our single-barrel shotgun. I entered the store and looked around. Nothing had changed. The old wood-burning potbelly stove still sat in the center of the store, with a few straight-backed chairs around it. The Cracker Barrel still had the 2 cents each sign, and the sour pickles were still 5 cents. Behind the counter, the storekeeper, Mr. Johnson, stopped reading the newspaper and took my list. As he gathered the items, I looked over the jars of Hard Rock candy. I was tempted to have a couple of jawbreakers put on Daddy's bill, but quickly changed my mind. After the items were placed in a brown paper bag, Mr. Johnson put a pencil from behind his ear. As always, he wet the end of the pencil and wrote what I had received on a small receipt pad. He tore out the yellow copy and handed it to me. After thanking Mr. Johnson and saying goodbye, I was out the door and headed for home. As I passed Mr. Jim and his best friend, I caught the term Wampus Cat. I lingered just long enough to hear how he had been chased down Black Gum Hollow and escaped by jumping into Little River. Someday I would get that old cat and be a hero. After returning home and giving Mom the baking goods, I walked outside. I took a deep breath and marveled at how the mountain seemed to go on forever. And the next story I have for you is titled Memories from a Cardboard Box, and this is by Carol Ann Lake. In the early 1950s, I was a toddler of about 2.5 years of age. My brother was 8 years older and my sister 4 years older than me. Most of the time, I was an observer of their very busy lives or a pest getting into their way. On one particular afternoon, we were gathered in the kitchen while our mother worked between the kitchen sink and the stove. My brother had acquired 2 large cardboard boxes and was attempting to construct a magic trick. He was reconstructing the illusion of the sword through the box, which was originally designed and constructed by a magician in 1924. We had magic shows, cowboys, and Saturday matinees for entertainment in our area. Those performers were our heroes and mentors. At about that time, our mother discovered that she was missing something she needed for that night's dinner. She told us she was just going to run out for a few minutes to our aunt's small grocery store, which was adjacent to our home. It was only going to be a few minutes. My brother was nearly 11 and all was well, for the moment. During those few minutes, my sister, as the lovely lady assistant, was to enter box number 2 and, without being seen, sneak over to box number 1. Box number 2 would remain empty and would be pierced with a sword made of forged steel with a blade sharp enough to cut a hair in half, or with a pocket knife with a blade about 2 inches long and as dull as a butter knife, whichever was more readily available. Details on how all of this was going to work were sketchy then and are even sketchier today. Unbeknownst to my brother, I had actually joined my sister in box number 2, but I never left. I remained there, sitting quietly, waiting to see whatever was about to amaze us. My head was just under the top of the box when my brother suddenly pierced box number 2 with the pocket knife and put a nick in my scalp. Not expecting this ill treatment, I started howling and my sister started screaming. Being the assistant, she grabbed a half a bottle of mercurochrome from the medicine cabinet and poured it on the top of my head so that it dripped down my face and back. She then ran out the door and met my mother halfway as she was coming back home from the store. "Mom, Dennis stabbed Carol in the head," she screamed. The real victim was most likely our mother, who could barely keep her legs supporting her to make it to the door. There I sat in a pool of fluorescent pink, my white blonde wisp of hair smelling medicinal and looking like an exotic bird. Mom had no idea what was blood and what was mercurochrome. Searching through my scalp, she could find no wound, but possibly identified a small scratch. By then, I was only crying because I knew something terrible had happened, and it was mostly likely the end of me. In the pandemonium that followed, I think the familiar words, "Wait till your father gets home," were spoken when our mom could speak again. That night, the boxes were burned to a soft pile of ash carried off on the breeze. The knife was confiscated. My sister was waiting for her hero's recognition, and my hair was scrubbed several times until it was a softer shade of pink. After our bedtime, which I think came extra early that night, our mom probably hit the cooking sherry, but we have no actual proof of that. 21 years later, I married a magician, and yes, we have done the sword through the box illusion many times. As of yet, we have not needed any mercurochrome or bandages. My brother also became a magician, entertaining young children for many years. Apparently, there was magic dust in our blood all along. And our next story is submitted by Ruth Smith, and it's titled Hard Times Party. There was going to be a party. In the height of the Depression during the 1930s, this didn't happen often, but it was Uncle Doc's birthday, and a party was called for. My dad's brother, Uncle Doc, a master carpenter, was one of the many out-of-work people throughout the country. There weren't too many mansions being built those days on the Gold Coast of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where his skills were appreciated but currently underutilized. My dad had a job, but Uncle Doc and his tiny, worrisome wife, Martha, were on relief. Once a week, Uncle Doc rolled out the old red coaster wagon to go to the relief station in their area, where he and other unemployed workers would receive food from the county for the week. There would be excess cheese, a smattering of meat, seasonal vegetables, and pantry staples. Unbelievably, there often was veal, and if there was, my uncle would whip up a recipe of Sulz, a German delicacy which he would share with the family. Snow had fallen the day before the party, which was great fun for a 7-year-old like me. However, on the cold Saturday night of the party, I was bundled up in warm clothing and a heavy woolen blanket and then propped in the wooden box atop my sled. I was entrusted to hold the coconut cake Mom had made, Uncle Doc's favorite and Mom's specialty. Dad was the power to pull the delivery. Stars twinkled, and there were few cars along the way. By the time we covered the mile to the party house, we were warm and ready for the festivities. As each relative arrived at the modest wooden home on Clark Street, there were lots of laughs, as this was a hard times party. Everyone had scrounged their oldest and most decrepit clothes to wear for the occasion. Uncle Doc took the prize with a pair of overalls tattered at the knees and topped by a faded red sweater held together by a number of safety pins. Aunt Martha kept apologizing for the outfit, but it was all in fun. I looked like an orphan in the old clothes Mom had pulled out of our rag bag. Then it was time for the ladies to settle in to play serious games of bunco in the parlor, while the men took over the kitchen for the traditional Schafkopf game. The hotly contested game was played for nickels, and you had better be on your toes if you were Grandpa Otto's partner. Winning hands were slammed atop the kitchen table to growls from the losers, and Grandpa never failed to cuss out his partner if they lost a hand. Bunco was taken seriously, too. The winner for the night would go home with a hand-embroidered dish towel made from a recycled flour sack. The absolute loser earned a bottle of homemade ketchup. Bunco came to a halt when it was time to put out the goodies everyone had brought for the late-night supper. Grandma's German potato salad was always a feature. There was rye bread to be slathered with the pounds of raw beef someone had splurged 50 cents on topped with thinly sliced onions, and don't forget the Schultz. Aunt Bertha's plump dill pickles and Aunt Anna's baked beans were added, and it seemed the table wouldn't hold one more item. Mrs. Zelinka, Aunt Martha's sweet elderly neighbor and practically one of the family, had brought her mouth-watering kolaches. They were filled with strawberry preserves, custard, or my least favorite, prune puree. It was my job to whip the cream that would dollop each kolache. Donning an extra sweater, I was set up on a step in the cold back hall with a rectangular metal whipper handle on the side. It seemed like it took forever to whip the cream, but the completed kolache was so scrumptious. And don't forget the coconut birthday cake. The men reluctantly stopped the Shopkoff tournament, and we enjoyed each specialty, saying happy birthday to Uncle Doc, and stuffed ourselves. Then it was time to bundle up for the walk home. By the time we reached the first corner, I was fast asleep in my wooden chariot. Good times were included at a hard times party. And I'm going to end today's program with just some tidbits of information. Here is a famous quote of Henry David Thoreau. Though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where no seed has been, I have great faith in a seed. Convince me that you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders. From Things My Parents Used to Say, Theresa Hewlett, via email, remembered her parents providing this sage advice. Never have two sets of table manners. Always use the nice ones at home, too. If she heard someone say something to put someone else in their place, Jody Conklin of New Windsor, New York, recalls her mother would say, "You tell them, my tongue's in my shoe." Here are some TV shows that premiered in 1965. Days of Our Lives, Get Smart, Green Acres, Hogan's Heroes, I Dream of Jeannie, and Lost in Space. And some popular 1959 songs, The Battle of New Orleans, 16 Candles, Come Softly to Me, Donna, My Heart is an Open Book. Do you remember any of these movies or songs? I do. I remember a few of the TV shows. We've run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And that number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.